Sullivan, who had lost their young daughter, Hannah, to cancer. Together they confronted their grief and began to heal, finding comfort in their shared circumstances and beliefs. The Sullivans and Browns would go on to organize, While We're Waiting, faith-based retreats for bereaved parents. On the evening of May 1, 2011, a little over a year since Adam's death, Kelly sat down to relax on the couch after an emotionally draining trip to Pittsburgh with Janice and Larry for the debut of a documentary called The Adam Brown Story on the NRA Life of Duty online television network. She cuddled up with Nathan and Savannah, switched on the television, and saw that President Obama was about to speak. Osama bin Laden was dead, the president announced to the world. A small team of Americans carried out the operation with extraordinary courage and capability. No Americans were harmed. They took care to avoid civilian casualties. After a firefight, they killed Osama bin Laden.
Nathan burst into tears, says Kelly. They were happy and sad tears. He's only 11, but he's smart, and the kids are not sheltered anymore. Their daddy was killed. They know what war is. Nathan was nodding while I said, I bet it was Daddy's friends. When we listened to Obama, I flashed back to what John Foss had said at the funeral. We will be hunting you down, and we are going to deliver you to the doorsteps of hell. This was coming from Team Six. He was talking to the men. But he was looking at the kids, and I heard it as, we are going to avenge your father's death. I just knew it was his team. It was such a release. It validated everything Adam did. We got him, and I was really happy about it. And little Savannah, she's so insightful. She asked, are we supposed to cheer because somebody died? I explained, your daddy was gone all these years to protect us from this man and others like him. They are not good. They're evil. They killed thousands of innocent people. Not just SEALs. It's okay to feel good that this man is gone, that he will never again do the things he did. The world knows that we won't ever put up with anybody else who does either.
Janice and Larry experienced the same closure, embracing Kelly when she dropped Savannah and Nathan off at their home a few days later on her way to the airport. They, too, had remembered John's words and had rejoiced in the death of a man they considered evil. Kelly flew to Virginia Beach the same day the media announced that it had indeed been SEAL Team 6 that took out bin Laden, and attended a get-together with her family of SEALs and their wives. They lifted their glasses to Adam and to another fallen teammate, whose widow stood beside Kelly. They toasted all the men from their command who had been killed in nearly 10 years of war. Then they toasted those who had lost their lives on September 11, 2001. As the night wore on, one of Adam's friends took Kelly aside and told her that bin Laden's death was further proof that Adam had not died in vain. It was a team effort, and Adam was a team player. He loved his country, God, and he loved you, Nathan and Savannah, more than anything in the world. When those guys were flying in, I bet they could feel Adam there with them, Kelly. I bet they could feel all the guys we'd lost. Although the DevGru SEALs I met with would occasionally bring up the bin Laden capture-kill mission during the many hours of interviews I conducted with them over the next few weeks, the topic was always in conjunction with Adam, specifically how he would have loved to have been there. Adam would have been badgering his team leaders for the primary roles, said one SEAL with a laugh. I can just hear that Arkansas accent. Don't worry, y'all. I got it. The laughter would often bring with it tears. Adam's death was a deep wound, far from healed. Kevin Houston had just finished recounting Adam's death when he broke down and cried. Apologizing, he walked outside on the balcony of the hotel room in Virginia Beach and stared out at the Atlantic Ocean, the same stretch of water where he and his SEAL brothers had trained over the years. Then he went on to tell me that he had spent a year pondering the question, how does this happen to a man like Adam? He had ultimately concluded that the trials and tribulations of Adam's life were grooming for a future job, I think that the Lord himself had one of his right-hand men, like an angel or however it works in heaven, set to retire, and Adam got called up to fill his place. 2 weeks later, Kevin went to church with his family and Austin and his family, and sat in the same pew they'd always shared with the Browns. At the end of the service, Kevin accepted Jesus into his heart and asked him to be his Savior.
"Adam really got him thinking," says Kevin's wife, Mei Ling, who called Kelly right afterward to tell her. "He finally did it. And I just want you to know, Adam's life was the seed that inspired him."
On August 6th, 2011, 6 weeks after that interview with Kevin, I was in the Sierra Mountains enjoying a camping trip with my wife, our children, and some friends, when Adam's teammates, now deployed in Afghanistan, were called upon to assist a combat element under attack and in need of immediate reinforcement. 7 of the 10 men I had met with from SEAL Team 6, Brian Bill, Chris Campbell, John Foss, Kevin Houston, Matt Mason, Tom Ratzlaff, and Heath Robinson, were locked and loaded on a CH-47 helicopter that was approaching a landing zone in Wardak Province when an insurgent-fired rocket-propelled grenade struck the aft rotor blade, causing the CH-47 to crash into a dry creek bed and explode. Everyone on board was killed, 30 U.S. forces and 7 Afghan soldiers. As my family and I left the mountains, our car filled with the laughter of grimy, happy kids, my cell phone coverage came back, delivering a voicemail box full of terrible news. Never could I have imagined that nearly every SEAL I'd visited with and spoken to about Adam Brown would perish in the single worst loss-of-life incident in naval special warfare history. When Kelly sat Nathan and Savannah down, she couldn't contain her tears.
"Who got killed?" Nathan immediately asked. "That's what happened, right?" "I'm so sorry, babies," said Kelly. "Some of Daddy's friends."
"Their faces dropped," says Kelly, as
they rattled off the nicknames. "Big Bird, Fozzie, Uncle Juicy." And I nodded after each one. 17 men. They knew all of them. Most were like uncles.
"Why?" said Nathan in tears. "Why is God doing this?"
says Kelly.
I tried to be strong. I thought, what would Adam want me to say? So I was honest. "I don't know," she told the children. "But let's pray for them and their families."
Over the next 3 weeks, Kelly traveled from state to state, attending 13 funerals to honor the men from Adam's team, putting aside her own grief and painful memories in order to comfort the widows and families, as she herself had been comforted the year before. Those few of Adam's close military friends, either not on the squadron that was hit or not deployed at the time, including Austin, Christian, Dave, and Jeff, joined her. The people who knew and loved these men, and the people who knew and loved Adam Brown, continue to ask why. Though the answers to this question vary, they share a common result. Solace. When Austin spoke at Kevin's funeral, he explained how he envisioned Adam taking Kevin's hand, and the hands of the others who had perished, and welcoming them to heaven as God's warriors. Heath Vance leans heavily on the story of a German colleague whose father's family had lost almost everything toward the end of World War II. An American GI brought food to the then 10-year-old boy to share with the rest of his family. "An act of kindness by a lone American soldier," says Heath. That impressed the boy so much, he eventually named his first son after the GI. "War heroes get celebrated," he says. "But it makes me incredibly proud to think about Adam and what those gifts of shoes may have done to win the war. How many Afghan kids will remember his name? And how might that heal our world just a little bit?" Adam didn't have an ulterior motive. He wasn't pushing hard to win the hearts and minds. He did it because he saw children with cold feet, and he wanted them to be warm. One seal returns often to a letter he keeps tucked in his Bible, written by Adam's commander in Afghanistan 2 days after he was killed, and sent out to every DevGru operator. A copy of the same letter is in Larry's desk drawer, in Kelly's box of special papers, and in a file meant for Nathan and Savannah when they're older. Adam gave his life for his teammates during a mission which can only be defined as classic SEAL Team 6 work in Afghanistan. The letter begins. It ends with, Adam was a friend, teammate, and brother-in-arms. Adam was a husband, and a son, and a father. Adam will always be a hero. His actions on his final mission were indicative of the way he lived his life. Fearless. Afterward. One of Adam Brown's final wishes, written by hand on his CACO form, was that his spiritual testimony, his complete story, be told, including my life before I met Jesus Christ and Kelly. You can appreciate now just how fearless Adam had been when he requested others to share that dark period from his past. Even in death, he selflessly and publicly risked tainting his own legacy so that others might be inspired to seek faith and overcome their own struggles. This was a special request that Kelly, Janice, and Larry Brown were determined to uphold. A few months before his final deployment, Adam and some of his fellow SEALs had met Rick Stewart, executive producer of the NRA Life of Duty online television network, whose mission is to honor those who serve our country. At the time, Rick was producing a documentary about a Special Forces A-team of Green Berets, ODA 574, based on my book, The Only Thing Worth Dying For, which chronicles 574's mission into southern Afghanistan in the weeks after 9/11. In March 2010, Tom Ratzlaff contacted Rick about Adam's death. This resulted in the Adam Brown story. www.nralifeofduty.tv/Adam Brown. www.fearlessnavyseal.com. A documentary that was set to debut in April 2011 at the NRA convention, an annual meeting in Pittsburgh, the same venue where I was going to speak about ODA 574. Rick picked me up at the airport, got me checked into my hotel room, then opened his laptop and allowed me to preview the Adam Brown story. From the opening scene with 8-year-old Savannah bravely describing her daddy, I was just as riveted, emotionally invested, and inspired as Rick had been when he was moved to produce the documentary. So, would you be interested in writing a book about Adam Brown? Rick asked. I'd be honored, I replied without a second thought. I'd call it Fearless. That's great, he said, because Kelly, Larry, and Janice Brown are flying into Pittsburgh tonight and want to meet you. Unbeknownst to me, Rick had told the Browns about my previous books, casting his vote for me to write Adam's story. At dinner that night, I had the pleasure of meeting the Browns, and with their very first hugs and handshakes, they made me feel like family. It had been barely a year since Adam had died, and as I told each one of them how sorry I was for their loss, the sadness in their eyes conveyed how fresh and deep the pain still was. While we were being seated, the hostess took my coat and handed me a coat check card with the number 24 on it. The significance escaped me, but for the Browns, who noticed the number as I tucked the card into my shirt pocket, it was a sign from God or Adam or both. They had been praying for guidance about telling Adam's story, and at that moment they were all but certain I would be the author. After dinner we drove to the Browns Hotel, where Kelly checked in, then walked over to us and held up her key envelope. Room 24, on the 24th floor of the hotel, had randomly been assigned to her. That's when she and Janice explained that 24 had been Adam's favorite number, and further, it was his and Kelly's secret code. If he came home late, he would call out, 24, to let her know who it was.
First your coat check, now this, Kelly said to me. I know this is Adam talking to me, and I would love it if you would tell his story.
I looked at the Browns and thought, are you sure?
We've just met. You should read my other books, I said, and Larry responded, We'll read them, but it feels right. You're the one.
The next day, the Browns and I walked the convention center floor with Rick, who introduced us to Ted Nugent, an avid supporter of the military who had just seen the debut of the Adam Brown story. Kelly informed him that I would be authoring the book about Adam, and he handed me a business card, asking me to send him a copy when it was published. Glancing at the card, I immediately got chills at the address. Okay, what are the chances? I thought. Within a day, the coat check, the hotel floor, the room number, and now the meeting of a rock and roll icon who lives at 2424 something street. I mulled over this string of 24s and Larry's statement to me, there is no such thing as coincidence, all the way through my arrival in San Diego the following night. Disembarking from the plane, I made my way to the baggage terminal, noticing the groups of people gathered around television screens that were tuned to CNN. I paused at one. Osama bin Laden was dead. At home, I gave my sleeping kids a kiss, then headed to my computer, where I discovered an email from Kelly with the subject line, Osama bin Laden. Eric, I'm almost certain it was Adam's team that got him, she wrote. I can just feel it in my heart. A few days later, the media announced that in fact it was. Despite the impact and magnitude of the bin Laden mission, Adam's story stands on its own. Throughout his life, he inspired scores of people, and his story has continued to change the lives of many, including mine. He's reminded me to appreciate every moment with my family, to be goofy rather than grumpy, to get back up no matter how hard I might get slapped down, to sometimes buy my children a cupcake when I pick up coffee in the morning, but to call it a muffin because, as Adam would tell Savannah, as long as you call them muffins, they're okay to eat for breakfast. And though I hadn't opened a Bible in more than 25 years, his faith encouraged me to question my own questioning about religion. Even with the knowledge that Adam truly was ready, body and soul, to give up his life in the line of duty, the final chapters of this book were heartrending to write. I knew what was coming, but I hoped for a different outcome somehow. Equally devastating and shockingly sudden was the loss of life on August 6, 2011, including Adam's friends and teammates, several of whom had sat with me for hours to ensure that his story would be rich in detail, to illustrate, so I might convey to the world, just how special he had been. While describing Adam, they had unknowingly defined themselves. Fearless in their own right, selfless, and not only willing but also proud to sacrifice their lives for the freedoms we enjoy every day.
Hello, this is Eric White, the production manager at Christian Audio. I'm in the studio today with Eric Belem to talk about his latest book, Fearless, The Undaunted Courage and Ultimate Sacrifice of Navy SEAL Team 6 Operator Adam Brown. Eric, welcome to our studio, and thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you got your start as a journalist writing for a snowboarding magazine. How in the world did you go from writing about that to top secret Green Beret missions in Afghanistan to ultimately inside the ranks of team or SEAL Team 6, essentially the first outsider to really gain the trust of these elite warriors?
Well, let me step back a little bit and just tell you how I got my start as a writer, and I like to always give credit to my mom. She passed away when I was 17 after a 4-year battle with cancer, and one of the last things, bits of advice that she imparted to me was, Eric, if there's anything in life that you want to do, do it now, because you truly don't know about tomorrow. And after I graduated high school, I decided I wanted to be a snowboard bum in Breckenridge, Colorado. And didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was going to a junior college. And by chance, when I was in Colorado, I was on a chairlift one day, a great powder day. And this guy sitting next to me started asking me questions about the town, about Breckenridge, about where the great powder stashes were after the storm, where to get good food, etc. And After all these questions, I asked him, so why all the questions? And he said, well, I'm a journalist. I work for a travel magazine or a newspaper from Austin, Texas, and I'm writing a story. And I stepped back and I thought about it. And I said, wow, you mean you get paid to come here, stay in Breckenridge, you know, for a week and write a story? What a scam. And I want to do that. And since it had been in my mind, and I said, so what did you study? And he said, journalism. And bam, that was kind of what got me interested. I was really big into snowboarding in the early days, and my dream was to write for a snowboarding magazine. And I went back to school, got a degree in journalism from San Diego State University, graduated in 94, and ended up being the editor of Transworld Snowboarding Magazine, which for me was kind of my ticket around the world. And my mom never got to travel much. My parents were kind of workaholics and put things off until they were going to retire. And for me, the big message that I took away from all of it was you have to live life along the way a little bit. If you just have a job, you're paying the rent, but you're not being fulfilled, and you're going to work your whole life, so you better enjoy it. So that was really about how I got into this. And fast forward to 9/11, and as a writer, I was starting to write books. I started as a magazine writer, did a lot of magazine articles, editor, decided I wanted to go freelance. And ultimately, after 9/11, I asked myself as a writer, what can you do? What could I do? How can I, you know, do my own part with this whole new world that we live in? And my thought was, I wanted to tell a story about the war. Any story. It didn't matter to me what my mom had always showed me and my parents. I had a great respect for the military. I was never in the military. In fact, here in San Diego, the closest I ever got to the military was in high school. I, you know, cropped my hair, shaved my head so I could drive past the guards at Pendleton to surf Del Mar jetties. It was, I'd go by and kind of salute on the way by, probably saluted completely wrong. And so that was a close, but I always had a great respect for the military. And that was what led me to finding a story about the Green Berets in Afghanistan, which was the first book I wrote on the topic, The Only Thing Worth Dying For, and then ultimately to SEAL Team 6. And the way I got into that inner circle of SEAL Team 6 really was just track record and trust. I worked with a special operations community. I was embedded with a platoon of Army Rangers in 1999, pre-9/11, on a training mission. And what you learn is, you know, these guys just want the story told accurately. They don't want the drama. They don't want to have the editor or writer put in their own political views. What they want is the story, the truth. And generally, the stories from the war are dramatic enough exactly as they occurred. They didn't need any embellishment. And so from just track record and getting to know these guys in the different branches of the military, I learned about Adam Brown. And that was kind of the beginning of this book process.
How did you first hear about Adam Brown?
I was watching a video, a documentary about his life, produced by Rick Stewart for the NRA Life of Duty Network. And they have Patriot Profiles, which are short documentaries on people, men and women who serve, whether at the civilian level, community service, police officers, CSI, or the military. And he had done a documentary on my previous book, The Only Thing Worth Dying For. And having gotten to know the family and team members, surviving team members from that A-team, he learned that I was trustworthy, the men respected me, and the families did. And when he started doing this documentary on Adam Brown, he told the family that I was potentially the right person to write his story because they did want his story told. And that was really kind of the very, very beginning. I was watching Savannah Brown, Adam's little 7-year-old daughter, and 10-year-old son Nathan on this video talking about their daddy who had passed away. And immediately I felt a calling to tell the story. I wanted to tell it for them, for their family. And immediately I wanted to call it Fearless, because when you watch the documentary, you learn all of his family, his friends, they all say that he lived his life fearlessly.
So, Eric, you mentioned in the book that when the U.S. Navy SEALs movie came out with Charlie Sheen, that Adam's friend said, oh, that movie's not about SEALs, that's about Adam. Is that the type of character quality in terms of fearless that you're referencing?
Adam's fearlessness was really multifaceted. He was fearless because he would jump off of a 40-foot bridge in the dark and do a gainer when all of his friends would maybe do it in the daytime and they'd just jump feet first. He was crazy that way and he was fearless. But he was also fearless because Adam had a checkered past, and one of the most fearless traits that he had is if ever he was to be killed in combat, he wanted his story told. And in the military, you can kind of assume that if you're killed in combat, you're going to kind of be remembered a hero of some sort, at least to the people back home. But Adam wanted to make sure that people remembered who he was before he accepted Jesus Christ into his heart and before he met his wife, Kelly. And so this is a spiritual journey as well, this story, and it's Adam's spiritual journey. And he was a felon, a crack addict. He went to jail. Somebody that, you know, they were the things that he wasn't very proud about. And to me, giving the go-ahead, encouraging people to talk about that so they can see what he rose up above, that is the definition of fearlessness. And Adam was fearless all the way around.
So once you decided that you were going to write his story, or in more in a sense of transcribe it, because it didn't need any invention or flourishes, where did you start?
I started by talking to his family, his closest friends, his teammates. And for me, it's important when you're telling someone's life story or any story is to speak only with eyewitnesses to events, people who were actually there. I discount any hearsay. I discount secondhand information. I just wanted to talk to the people who had been with Adam during different aspects of his life to tell the story. And in addition, to have access to his letters, journals, the actual records, in this case, both military and criminal. If you can slow down and just focus on what people remember clearly about someone's life or a certain story, everybody has a different perspective of a single event, but the most accurate, I believe, way to do it is to just talk with people who were there.
And so you got a really good perspective, reading the letters, talking to eyewitnesses.
When Adam would write letters to his children or his wife or his family, there are certain sentences that you read from an individual that you know are telling. They tell so much, and you know they're going to go in the book. In this case, I'm referring to, he was writing a letter to his kids talking about the scandal going on where there was a lot of American soldiers that were mistreating, degrading the prisoners in a prison in Iraq. And Adam was just beside himself with anger that they were doing this. And he wrote and admonished his children to, first of all, always respect your fellow humans. And two, that if they were trying to maybe do something that was going to elevate themselves, you know, maybe they were very insecure individuals. And he said that to his kids. He said, your actions are what show your courage. You never have to prove it. Your actions are proven, are proof enough. And certain lines like that are just, you know, so telling. So as you read these letters, the journal entries, you talk to the family, you see the tears, you join them in the tears, you know the emotional aspects of the story. It really just kind of unfolds in front of you. And with Adam and his story, I just kind of had to hold on and be taken along for the ride.
So, Eric, how did a man like Adam, with a criminal record, a drug history, gain top secret clearance and get access into DEVGRU, let alone get into the Navy?
That is a question that I had myself when I went into this and when I started learning the dark side of Adam's past. And I will tell you, one thing absolutely, Adam's past, his reputation as a young man, people got to know him, and so we had, people knew there was this good, pure person deep inside. So when he went down this wrong path, there were people that were there, let's just say, as reference for him. But when you follow his career and the fact that he did get in the Navy after signing a stack of waivers, and ultimately all the way up to the top secret clearance, considering the record that he had, if Adam Brown was sitting here right now, I can tell you without a doubt that the one reason he would say he made it to where he was by the grace of God.
So, Eric, what are some of the main things that you wanted to communicate in this story? One of the things you had mentioned was letting the story tell itself. It doesn't need any help. But were there any other things that you just wanted to make sure were clear, undefiled?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. I do want to make sure that the story just tells itself. And I probably oversimplified it a little bit by saying it just unfolds, because I did toil over the structure of the story, you know, to whether or not to let people know, for instance, that Adam Brown does die at the end of the book, and that you find that out in the first sentence of the book, as you know. But there's a structure to it, and you have to kind of spoon feed the reader the aspects, the different parts of Adam's life. And I mean, I wanted people to understand that he was this model kid. He was a kid that would open doors for people. He would stand up for the underdog. He was really the person that, the kid that, you know, you would hope you would get. And that had to be conveyed. You had to convey that he was, you know, crazy and wacky and goofy. And he also had to convey the challenges he had to overcome. His family, you know, when I went in to write this story, they let me know right off the bat. And I told them it was critical that the only way people will understand how high Adam rose was to show how hard he fell and how deep into the darkness he was originally. And so I really had to give the bookends of his life, but I had to absolutely convey how dark it was. And then, as far as overcoming the different obstacles beyond the lifelong addiction, but also just the physical challenges. You know, he had to learn to shoot left-handed with his non-dominant eye in a qualification process that most of the top SEALs in the world fail. You know, he became the top 1%, and people would ask, even now, after reading the book, how did he do it? One of his armorers who would help out with his rifles, as I say in the book, asked him one time just casually, you know what, come on, come clean, you're a Jedi, right? And that, it's funny. I mean, we all love Star Wars references and we can all relate, but truly those guys are at that intuitive level. They're the type that, you know, if they're holding a lightsaber, then all of a sudden they spin around for no reason and bash, you know, somebody sneaking up on them. That is kind of a level. There's an intuitive nature with the operators at DevGrew that has to be achieved and is just innate. You can't fake it. You either have it or you don't. Adam was as tough or tougher than anybody. His buddies called him the toughest SEAL they'd ever known. I mean, he had his fingers crushed off, and he was still trying to help his buddy.
Yeah, that scene is ingrained in my mind of the vehicle flipping over, and when I drive down the road and I have my hand hanging just outside the edge of the window, I always think about that.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, to have it flip, and you see the photo that's in the book of the Humvee, and that front right seat, it doesn't look like there's anywhere someone could be sitting still and be alive. And the fact that that all got crushed, and with it his hands, and then he, you know, it's amazing he was still standing. I mean, that's another kind of a situation in his life where people said there was somebody there beside him, and it wasn't one of his fellow SEALs.
To go back real quick, you talked about painting the book ends and making sure that you don't know how high he rose until you know how far he had fallen. I found that part really resonated with me and with some other people that had had an ear into the story, of just personally knowing people like that, and then being able to see to go from experiencing the anger and the frustration towards, you know, Adam exhibiting those things to rising where he did. That was phenomenal. But how was that for you as a writer, as you dove back into his past? How challenging was that for you to have those details unfold and then have to write them out?
Yeah. Well, it was, I have some, you know, we all know people that have had issues and, family, friends, whoever. And, like probably anyone, I know people who never did rise above that darkness in their life. And for Adam, you know, it's a tragic story, but it's also an uplifting story because he rose above so much. And, be it his faith, be it his achievements here on earth, be it just his, who he inspired along the way. As I'm writing all this, I know what the end of the story is. And I'm interviewing these people and it's kind of like watching a train wreck. You know, they say, you know, people will sit there and watch even though they are dreading the outcome. And when you're actually writing the story, the weight of Adam, of the honor that I had to convey with Adam, the fact that I had to make sure that the tragedy did not overshadow the valor and what's uplifting about the story. That was always riding on my shoulders as I wrote the story. And I have to tell you, I don't know how I did it in some cases. I'd be working long hours, 17-hour days, very common for 6 months straight, just to make the deadline and to get this out, to make the production schedule that the publisher wanted. And there were times where I was so fried that I would just kind of sit at the computer and then all of a sudden something would just hit me. And I would pull something out that was, you know, I would write it and I'd read it back. And as a writer, anyone who's a writer would appreciate this. I would just say, huh, what? That's actually pretty good. That's okay. And I don't know how, and it just happened a lot and a lot more than it has ever happened in any other book. I feel like, you know, Adam, was there helping me out along the way. There was some guidance going on, I think, because it just really did flow out in a way that no other book has for me.
So Eric, on page 103, Adam's friend Christian says of Adam, becoming a SEAL wasn't a dream for him. It had been his last hope. This is a very different perspective that you see compared to many military biographies. How did this understanding of Adam influence your writing dealing with Navy SEAL Team 6? That, you know, it wasn't a dream for him, but it was his last hope.
Yeah. Well, being an avid reader myself of military and military history, there's so many stories where the military was a family tradition. Now, granted, Adam's grandfather had been in World War II. In fact, he survived and helped hold the line at Bastogne in the Battle of the Bulge, one of the more horrific battles that we won in World War II. His father was not drafted. He volunteered for Vietnam. But at the same time, it wasn't a tradition. They did their service at the time during war, and Adam got into it really as a last chance. I mean, he did not have any other options. He did not know what to do, and it came to him in a way that, you know, his good friend suggested, "Hey, how about the Navy?" And for Adam, he had been lacking direction. He had been a team player in high school, loved football, strove to make his team a state champion or runner-up state champion, which, you know, small school, big deal, you know, bragging rights in Garland County, Arkansas. But for many years, he had not had that sense of teamwork and that sense of just having something to work toward. And the Navy provided that for him. But he had the gumption and the drive to just not stop. And he had so many injuries that would have stopped most people. In fact, he was disabled. I mean, he deployed one time while his leg was still technically broken. And he, so I would say how it influenced my writing. It just made me want to let the reader understand where Adam came from, really. You just had to understand the full background. And a lot of stories like this, you want to start, people want to get to the action. And one of his good friends who I interviewed, Kevin Houston, fellow teammate, said, "Eric, don't start this story with BUDS, you know, basic underwater demolition SEAL training in San Diego. Don't start with, you know, a battle. Don't throw the reader into the mix when Adam's already a SEAL. You have to understand who he was and where he came from to really appreciate the fact that he did what he ultimately did." And that was really, you know, Kevin Houston's advice was spot on. You couldn't. And so this book doesn't start off with a ton of action. You get his biography. It's truly a biography. And again, that's just important. So I don't know if that really conveys how it influenced my writing, but the importance was you have to understand the past to get to the core of his special operations life, or his, you know, naval special warfare SEAL part of his life. You had to understand everything about him, and that was the son, the brother, the boyfriend, the husband, the father, before you understand the SEAL.
Eric, what are some of the details that didn't make it into the book?
So many details didn't make it in the book. And it's not that anything was being held back, it's just that in a book you want to convey those different aspects of a person's life, and you don't want to be redundant. Now, each little anecdote conveys a similar trait. And for Adam, that might have been the craziness, the, you know, him wanting to bash people on the football field, the fact that he was little and he still loved to just run full speed into someone twice his size. He was, as his principal, Richard Williams, said once, you could tell Adam to run through a brick wall and he'd figure out a way to do it. And so some of the stories that did not make it in the book were completely written out. But as you're writing a story, you just don't know how long the story is going to be. And we wanted this to be the essence of Adam Brown. And so you synthesize everything down to the best stories to convey each part of his personality that you want to convey. But there's one story in particular that I thought was just hilarious. And it just, we had to cut some of our favorite stories. And so when he was young, he was about 6 years old. His brother was 11. And they went to do some batting practice at a friend's house. And they lived out in Arkansas, and to get to his friend's house, there was, of course, a shortcut. Now, that shortcut went across a field that had a sloping hill on one side and a sloping hill on the other with a ravine on the center. Now, of course, in the middle, at the lowest point in this little journey, there is a mean dog that we called Cujo, of course. And he wanted to come home, and his older brother, Sean, is at the top of the hill, and he takes off running to get across this danger zone. He gets to the other side, and he looks, and he realizes Adam, his six-year-old brother, is still on the other side. And he looks over at Adam, and he goes, "Run, Adam!" And Adam takes off running, and at the bottom, at the crux of the journey, there's Cujo just booking through the woods, through the tall grass of this field, right towards him. Now, six-year-old Adam, he's carrying the baseball bat. He had the wherewithal to stand, face that dog, get into a stance like he's at the plate, and he cracked that dog right in the head.
Oh, my gosh.
And then took off running full speed up the other side of the hill. His brother got home, and they made it back to their house, and they're at the dinner table, and Adam's proud the whole way home, like, oh, boy. He was shaking. He said he was like the adrenaline was just surging, and his dad and mom heard about it, and Sean said, you know, I saw that dog running across the field. I thought Adam was going to get killed. He said, but a couple seconds later, I was worried Adam killed the dog. Now, Cujo did survive, by the way. He did make it back. But that is just a glimpse into who he was. He would do, as I shall, like, he was the belly flop king. He would do six belly flops in a row at football camp into the pool, but he did it off the high dive. I mean, flat out, beautifully executed, flat as a board, belly flops. He also did that into the creeks, the Muzzern Creek that run into Lake Hamilton. He was out on a canoeing trip one time, and his buddy Heath Vance was with him, and he remembered seeing Adam pull his canoe over because he found this little pool. Now, this pool was about between knee-deep and waist-deep, and there was a branch hanging over the water about 20 feet up. He shimmied up the tree, and Heath is in there saying, "Don't do it, Adam, don't do it." Adam was just calm and got out onto that branch, set himself up, and dropped. And he dropped 20 feet. You know, we're talking, you know, close to a telephone pole height, into this water that was no more than waist deep, hit flat, and he survived. And he said he laid there for minutes, and then he jumped up and threw his fists in the air and said, "Yeah!" And everybody thought, "You, Adam Brown, you are an idiot. You just took like 4 years off my life. I thought you were dead." He said, "Ah," he said, "I didn't even touch bottom." And so that was the type of guy Adam was. And these are a couple of little bits that didn't make it in the book. But there were a lot of little stories like that. And, you know, as you know, there are others that are even better in the book. They're just different. And all of them add up to who Adam Brown was. He was an individual, an inspiration. You know, he was, again, like I said, he would stand up for people. He knew at a very young age, when a lot of people are downright mean, you know, teenagers, that he would make people feel good. There was one kid that he went to school with, and according to his friends, he was a kid that was, he's kind of overweight. He didn't really have very many friends. And Adam would make it an effort to include him. You know, if they were picking team sports, he would pick the person he knew would get picked last if he was the captain, because he didn't want the person degraded of being the last one picked. So he would make sure that the ones he knew would be picked last were picked first. That was just the type of guy Adam Brown was.
And you know what? What you did include, I think, really says that very loudly. You know, I think about where he was assisting before he was a Trident pinned SEAL. He was assisting a group on a 4-hour training mission, and he stabbed himself in the forehead with his pup knife.
Yes.
and he stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, describes him going under the water at the end, and he's coming up and his mask is, you know, half full of blood, and, you know, he's emptying it out, going back under. You know, those really show what you've just described, you know, the character of who Adam was.
Yeah, absolutely. Character. He, like as his buddy said, everybody knew that Adam Brown was not going to let anybody take up his slack, you know, and even if he was bleeding, and he was like that his entire life.
Eric, you had written an earlier book called The Only Thing Worth Dying For, where you highlighted a Special Forces Green Beret mission into southern Afghanistan, really the first mission into southern Afghanistan after September 11th. How was that book different than writing Fearless?
Well, first of all, Fearless is a biography of one person, and that is the story of a mission and a team. The difference, first of all, between the different branches of the military and the different elite soldiers are the things that I learned right off the bat. Their missions are entirely different. Special Forces Green Beret, their specialty is guerrilla warfare, where they go into a country, they team up with the locals, they build a militia out of the populace, and they generally use it to rise up against a tyrannical government. In this case, it was the Pashtun trying to get them to rise up against the Taliban. Now, Navy SEALs also do guerrilla warfare and train the troops of other countries, but their specialty, and especially the specialty once you get to the level of SEAL Team 6, is direct action. In other words, you're not going in to meet with the locals and build a militia. You're going in to attack a high-level leader, a cell, a position. It is direct action. So two very different specialties. So you learn about that as you dive into the different branches and the different levels of these elite warriors. But with Adam Brown, again, this was a biography about one person. And as you got to know Adam Brown, you got to understand the team. With ODA 574, which was the A-team that's the focus of The Only Thing Worth Dying For, there it was just very, very different. I mean, there was a focus of the team captain, who was Captain Jason Amerine. But talk about two polar opposites. Captain Amerine was an agnostic, he at best agnostic and self-proclaimed, you know, potentially an atheist. Whereas we know Adam Brown ultimately becomes a devout Christian. And so the spirituality of the two main characters could not be more different. And in my opinion, you tell the story, you tell the facts, and let the actions of the individuals convey whatever the reader wants to take away from it. I always think it's important to let the reader make their own decisions. You tell the story the best you can, accurately. Let the reader take away what they want. And again, you're learning about two different types of military, two very different people, but at the same time, their characters, their stories, they all deserve to be told.
Eric, you mentioned that you just want the reader to hear the facts and let them determine what they may. One of the things that I noticed in Fearless is that in the midst of a story of a war that is highly politicized, you seem to be able to leave out any slant or angle. It seemed essentially the bare facts, other than what Adam thought, but you were able to leave out almost any political references. Was that intentional? Is that what you had aimed for?
Yeah, it kind of goes in with what I just was talking about, where I believe it's important to let the reader decide, and to present the story that stays true to your topic, to your main character. In this case, you definitely will understand that Adam Brown completely and 100% believed in the wars he was fighting, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. But myself, as the narrator, I don't editorialize. I don't add anything extra. If he says something, there's a comment in a letter, it's going in there. I'm not going to keep it out. But I'm not going to add to that by including my own political slant, anything like that. It's, to me, when I wrote The Only Thing Worth Dying For, some people would ask, I have no idea what your politics are after reading this book. And to me, that was the ultimate compliment, because I do want to keep myself out of the story. It takes away from the subject if you insert yourself. It's two different types of writing. I mean, there's people who really want to have the author's opinion. I just choose, and in the books I've written thus far, to keep out of it and let the power of the story be conveyed by the truth of that, whatever the topic you're discussing.
Mm-hmm. So after you had began your research for Fearless, shortly after that, Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan. And then there was the tragic accident where 30 Special Forces operators were shot down in their helicopter shortly after that in August of 2011. How did those things affect your research?
The accident profoundly affected the research. First of all, it was nice that I agreed to and began doing research just literally days before Osama bin Laden mission, because for me that was just a nice little addition to taking on the story, because I didn't feel like I was jumping on the bandwagon with everybody else who wanted to write something suddenly about SEAL Team 6. I'd already been asked by the family, by the Brown family, to write Adam's story, and had started learning about Adam's life, and then, boom, that happened. The horrible thing, the tragic thing, the thing that kind of haunts me still, is that I interviewed a lot of Adam's close friends who were teammates, and of a large number of them, the majority of the guys I interviewed were shot down in the Chinook on August 6th. And so I had been interviewing these guys. I'd met with them. I'd gone to Alaska to meet some of them. I'd gone to Virginia Beach, met their families in some cases, their wives. I sat down for anywhere from 2 to 6 hours with them as they told me Adam Brown's story. And they wanted to tell me his story because they knew that they were about to deploy. They were going on another rotation into Afghanistan, and quite a few of them verbalized, you know, on tape, you know, Eric, I want to talk to you because we're going on this mission, and I just, you know, you never know what might happen. I could get killed on my first op. And sadly, horribly, tragically, that happened exactly, but not just one. I mean, in my worst nightmares, I would have never imagined that so many of the guys I interviewed just weeks later would be killed. And when I found that out, I was still working on transcribing their voices, you know, and they were dead. They had already been killed in this mission. And so as they're sitting there talking about their own families and what they do as SEALs, as they were trying to convey who Adam was, as I listened to them over and over again and transcribed their interviews, read the transcripts, I realized that they were really, you know, they were telling me who Adam Brown was, but at the same time, they were defining themselves. And there's this quality among the SEALs, among the Brotherhood, and you can't really put your finger on it, but there's just an aura of confidence and strength And these guys are just very, very special individuals, and it is a tragic, huge national loss that they were all killed, because these men, they were fathers, they were husbands, they were men who would become fathers, and their lives were cut short, and they did it to protect our freedoms, and I will never forget any of them, and that's why I dedicated the book to all of them, and I just wanted to honor Adam Brown because that was their wish, and at the same time, you get a sense of who they are, and it's just absolutely horrible what happened, but as many of them said, if I'm going to go, I want to go like Adam Brown, on a mission, on an op. If I can't live to be 100, I want to go like this. And so, you know, it was prophetic for some of them who said exactly that on tape, but at the same time, you know, they were warriors. That was their chosen profession. They understood the risks, and you've heard it so many times, you know, just to kind of alleviate some of the sorrow and the pain, but they died doing what they loved, and they did it honorably, and they did it for us.
Eric, I think that really ties this interview together. You'd started at the beginning saying that your mom had motivated you to do something you loved, to work, and to do something that would fuel you and that you would be proud of. And you invest quite a bit of time telling the story of Adam Brown, who hit the bottom and was given strength to rise back up, and eventually to end with the death of some of his closest friends and teammates who also were doing what they loved and what they were proud of. So thank you, Eric, for everything that you've shared with us. Thank you for your time writing that book and telling his story, but also giving an opportunity for the additional friends and teammates to have their voices heard also.
It really was my honor. If there's one thing that I hope people leave after reading this book, leaves with them, is that people will understand truly the sacrifices that these military families give for all of us. And they're, you know, Adam individually, you know, I think that, again, his book will inspire many to rise up above their own personal demons. And, you know, in Adam's case, to seek faith, to know that there is hope, that there is a way out of that hole. And Adam was in a deep hole, and he rose above it. And as one of his buddies said at his funeral, hey, you know, we kind of thought we'd be sitting here at Adam's grave 15 years ago, and it would have only been you and me and maybe his parents here. Instead, here are thousands of people from Hot Springs, and he's a hero. And what better legacy? You know, if you're going to get a second chance at life, Adam did amazing things. And he did it for himself. He did it for humanity.
And I think that maybe you would agree, Eric, that if he was here right now, and we asked him, Adam, how did you do it? Not just joining the SEALs, not just, you know, becoming this great hero, but in everything, would you agree that he would say, again, the grace of God?
There is not a doubt in my mind that that is what Adam Brown would say.
Eric, thank you for spending the time with us today. Listeners, this was Eric Blem, the author of Fearless, The Undaunted Courage and Ultimate Sacrifice of Navy SEAL Team 6 Operator Adam Brown. And if you are interested, Eric has 3 books total, and you have another one. Would you go through those real quick just to let the listeners know the other books that you've written?
My 3 previous books are The Last Season was my first book, which is the story of a National Park Service backcountry ranger who went missing in the High Sierras many years ago, and I tell the story of his disappearance and his life story, the search and rescue operation to find him. And it was a National Outdoor Book Award winner, and it was the Sierra is a very special place for me, the mountains in the High Sierra, and the Sierra is really a main character in that story itself. The next book is The Only Thing Worth Dying For, which we spoke about, the first Special Forces ODA 574 that infiltrated southern Afghanistan after 9/11. And they are the team that actually linked up with an unknown statesman at the time named Hamid Karzai, who ultimately became the interim leader and then first democratically elected leader of Afghanistan. Those 11 men on that A-team, in the course of a 4-week mission, every single member of that team was either wounded or killed. And so this is the story of how Karzai really did rise to power, and from the perspective of the men who were there closest with him, these Green Berets. And then, of course, we have Fearless.
And is there a book about an owl?
Ah, and I did do a children's book as well, a couple of children's books called Molly the Owl, and it is a nonfiction. It's a true story about an owl family in San Marcos, California, where Carlos Royal put an owl box in his backyard, and it was occupied by an owl that he named Molly and her mate, who he named McGee. And he put a camera in it, in the box, and streamed it live on the internet. And 14 million people around the world watched this owl rear this family of owlets, and that's the topic of Molly the Owl.
You're working on a new book also?
I am. It's kind of under wraps at the moment. But I will say that you should have something else from me out within a couple of years.
Well, Eric, thank you. And this is Eric White, the production manager for Christian Audio. Thank you so much, Eric Blem, and look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you for listening to this recording of Fearless, the undaunted courage and ultimate sacrifice of Navy SEAL Team 6 operator Adam Brown, by Eric Blem. This book was read by Paul Michael. Please visit christianaudio.com, facebook.com/christianaudio, or twitter.com/christianaudio to offer your impressions of this work and to explore additional titles.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.